I want to extend Christian greetings to all your brothers and sisters here from Bancroft, Ontario. And I would also say, on behalf of our brothers and sisters in Bulgaria, I would say, Privetstvamiye sapasnayam. That's what they say in Bulgaria when they meet or are glad to greet someone. We were in Bulgaria for 3 months last fall and early winter, and I'd like to thank you for your prayers. As I understand, when I had a medical challenge or two, that you were praying back here in North America, and thank you for those prayers. God is able to work any place in the world and through people we have never met before. So may God bless you for that. In 2013, my wife and I and two other couples went to Bulgaria in the fall of 2013 to investigate the options and possibilities of starting a outreach work in that country. We rented a house and we lived there for 2 weeks and made various contacts and investigated a number of possibilities. We contacted a man who we had been told could be a language teacher, Netko Popov, who we met once on an official level to discuss language teaching. And then we went to his church Sunday morning, a Baptist church. Netko was a school teacher for 20-some years in his life, and very fluent in English. And we have since hired him as our official language teacher. That Sunday evening, one of the sisters said, "Why don't we call them and invite them for Sunday evening for supper at our house?" So that's what we did, or emailed them, I guess, and then they responded and they said they'd be glad to come, him and his wife and a daughter. So they came and they spent Sunday evening with us. And we discussed a lot of things, and he wondered what we have in mind, what's our objective. If we're thinking about coming to Bulgaria, what do we have in mind? Well, it's a little difficult to define that in a few words, I guess, but we told him that we're interested in spreading the gospel, first of all, to the Bulgarian people, particularly those who have not been exposed to a true gospel. The country is 80% Orthodox, which is Eastern Orthodox. There's not much salvation in that faith and that church. A pretty dead religion, really. And the other evangelical groups are very small, Baptist, Pentecostal, Methodist, and a few others. So we told them that our first objective would be to get sound Christian literature into the Bulgarian people's homes, because I asked Netko, I said, I'd like to get into a Christian bookstore, if there's any in Bulgaria, in the city of Plovdiv, where we were. He said, no, there isn't any Christian bookstore at all. There's only one in Sofia, the capital, and he said the books they have aren't worth reading. So there's a huge opportunity for sound Christian literature. And Grace Press has been very active in producing literature, booklets, and tracts. I think they have probably close to 30 booklets of various titles. And more recently, they have now got First Steps Bible Study Correspondence Course translated and printed. Anyway, I'm getting a little bit off my trail that I was on. That evening, as we discussed with Netco our vision of a church in Bulgaria that is based on Bible doctrine as we understand it. I'll never forget what his response was. He said, I believe that there's room for an Anabaptist type of church in Bulgaria. He's a Baptist man, his brother-in-law is a preacher of the Baptist church. But he said, I believe there's room for an Anabaptist type of church in Bulgaria. A little later, he said, our people don't know how to live the Christian life. They need somebody to show them how a real Christian ought to live. After we've been there for 3 months and observed the lifestyles of even professing Bulgarians, Christians, his words really struck home. How true those words were. Even in a Baptist church, and we didn't visit too many others, we did a couple, at Church of God, we were at a couple. And there is a faith there that is to be observed. They are people that are endeavoring to live the Christian life as they know it, and as they've been taught it, I guess, which hasn't been very deeply or broadly. So there is a need there, first of all, to get literature into the hands and into the homes of Bulgarian Christian families, that they might learn more completely what the Bible really teaches when it comes to home life, child training, and all aspects of Christian living. So this morning, I want to talk about appreciating our Anabaptist heritage. I had this message at home a while back, and I think it's important that our oncoming youth and oncoming generations are reminded of what the Anabaptist heritage really is. And what we are enjoying today because of some brothers and sisters back in Europe enduring immense hardships and suffering, and yea, even death, so that you and I can enjoy the freedom of conscience and freedom of the Christian faith and church life that we do today. I don't know how many here can trace their ancestors back to the Anabaptists in Europe. Anybody here can do that? A few. Well, I've been in Europe, Switzerland, where my ancestors come from, a number of times over the last 20 years. About 4 years ago, my oldest daughter and son-in-law and I, we went to Switzerland, and we went up into the hills south of Zurich. And we went to a cave there that was a well-known cave in Anabaptist days, where the believers would go there on Sunday to worship their God. And it was quite a hike up that trail to climb up into the hills and steep pathways to go till you finally got up to that cave. And it said that they went up there in the morning, Sunday morning, before it was daylight. They didn't want to be discovered, so they had to go up there when it was still dark Sunday morning. How many started out for church this morning here before sunrise? Nobody. They would take their lunch along, and they would worship God up there in that cave all day long. In the evening, they would descend from the hills after dark to return to their home. I don't know how many years they did that, but that is the kind of thing that happened many, many places over Europe, particularly in Switzerland. My mother's side, my mother was a Bauman, and the Baumans come from Switzerland. They come from a town called Hirzel. We went there, we went to the Reformed Church. We saw in the cemetery the tombstones of some of my ancestors. They grew up in the Reformed, Swiss Reformed Church. They were baptized as babies. There was a baptismal font in the front of the church where parents would bring their babies when they were a week old or so to be baptized. My ancestors were baptized as babies. In the early 1700s, some of them fled to Alsace, France, and lived there for a time before they came to America. Most of you are familiar with the Dordrecht Confession of Faith, put together by faithful ministers and bishops and deacons, who they all were, at Dordrecht, Holland, 1632, I believe. The Swiss Brethren never signed that document at that time. They signed it about 40 years later, because they had some differences with the Dutch and German Anabaptists, so they didn't sign that document immediately, but about 40 years later. In Alsace, we went to visit an old grist mill along a river, where those men gathered one day and signed the Dordrecht Confession of Faith. That old mill is still standing. And one of the men that signed that document was one of my ancestors, a man by the name of Bauman. Instead of Bauman, they used to call him Bauman, but it's the same name. Being able to trace your ancestors back to the Anabaptists is not the most important thing in the world. But we want to instill within all of us a greater appreciation for what those men and women stood for and what they went through in order to live out what they believed was a biblical faith and a biblical church life. I'd like to turn to Hebrews chapter 11. And I want to read a few verses out of this chapter, which I believe are appropriate. Hebrews 11, verse 32. Let me break in there and read a number of verses. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Barak and of Samson and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in flight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. I realize this passage is talking about people before this was written. People who lived for God before Hebrews was ever written. This is recorded as past tense. But many of the events that are described here were the experiences of many Anabaptists. Many Anabaptists experienced exactly some of these same things that are recorded here. When we were in Switzerland, we went to a castle called Trotzelwald Castle. How many here have Burkholder blood in their veins? Anybody? Any Burkholders here? Not too many. Well, we went up the prison tower of that castle, trudged up the stone steps, and there were different levels, three or four levels in that tower, and they had prison cells built into them. One of those cells, a man by the name of Christian Burkholder spent time in that prison. I think his name was Christian. Why? Not because he was a criminal, at least not in the eyes of God. Because he was an Anabaptist, that's why. He was arrested, put into a prison cell, and believe me, those prison cells were not pretty. They weren't pretty at all. We looked at the hard benches that they would have had to sleep on, and a cold stone tower. There was no heat in those prison cells, from what I could determine. Only the clothes that they would have had on would have kept them somewhat from freezing. We have a spiritual heritage. We often don't fully appreciate what that heritage has cost our forefathers. We know the story of the Reformation. In medieval Europe, there was an upheaval that started in about 1522 or a little before, when Luther and Zwingli began to chomp at the bit, so to speak, to reform the corrupt church. I was in Zurich, Switzerland, back, probably one of the first times I was there would have been 1977. Along the Limmat River, and by the way, Limmat River is where the first Anabaptist martyr was drowned. Felix Mons was drowned in the Limmat River, close to the Grossmünster Church, where Zwingli was the pastor, the preacher, Sunday mornings. Out in the courtyard between the church and the river, there's a statue of Zwingli. I was struck by that statue every time I've seen it, because there is that man in stone holding a Bible in one hand, he has a sword in the other hand. Now I looked at that. This is the Book of Life, right? He had the Book of Life in one hand, and he had a weapon of death and destruction in the other hand. Do those two things go together? Hardly. Yet he attempted to preach the gospel of love and salvation, life on one hand, and if people didn't agree with him, I got a sword here, I'm going to use it. And he did. The poor man died on the battlefield. That image has never left my mind. There's that large and life man standing statue with a Bible and a sword. Two things that certainly the Anabaptists did not agree that those two things went together, because they didn't. A few years ago, we took a tour of Zwingli's church. Their Grossmünster church is still standing the way it was when he was there over 400 years ago. They had some kind of a commemoration of the Reformation days in that church that week. And as we went through it's a large edifice, they had booths set up and they had posters put up, tacked up, signs and outlining the Reformation and its various aspects. Brother Marion Miller from North Carolina was with me, and we were walking through there. We come to this one booth, and something caught our eye. The word Anabaptist was on one of these placards tacked up. So we started reading what it said in there. That was about 2004, I believe. It described the Anabaptist movement a little bit, that they were a parallel Reformation to this Swiss Reform, which is really, that was true. But the writer put the Anabaptists in a bad light. What they wrote on that placard looked down on the Anabaptist movement. That was 2004. They were still considering Anabaptists to be traitors or whatever. They looked down on the Anabaptists as a radical cult, I guess, but they could not support. I think since the Reformed Church there has made some amends and has acknowledged that a lot of wrongs were done by the Reformed Church against the Anabaptists. But Roman Catholicism had ruled the day for many centuries, and then as Zwingli and Luther saw the corruptness of the Roman Church, they knew it was high time for a reformation. And they began that attempt to reform in about 1522. By 1525, we had the movement of the Swiss Brethren that began. Men like Felix Manz and Conrad Grebel, Blaurock, those were the early men that formed the beginning of the Swiss Brethren. And that expanded then as their message was preached in the Swiss villages and farmhouses and so on. Those early men didn't last very long. Felix Manz, I'm not sure how long after his baptism and conversion until he was drowned in the Lamont River. Blaurock was expelled from Zurich. Conrad Grebel, his ministry lasted all of 1 year and 8 months. And then he was martyred too. What were the issues back there? That is what is important for us to understand what the issues were. Some of the issues are not quite what we face today, and yet some of them are. One of the issues that the early Anabaptists had with the state reformers was the authority of the scriptures versus the authority of the church, especially church leadership. The Anabaptists had a slogan that they often used, even in some of their writings. They claimed the sole authority for their lives was sola scriptura. The Latin expression for the scriptures only. There's no other authority that we need to govern our lives by than by the Scriptures. Another issue, a very prominent issue then, was believers' baptism versus infant baptism. The Reformers never did get away from infant baptism. They still baptize babies, whether they're Lutherans, the Swiss Reformed, and the English Church of England, the Scottish Church, all those churches kept infant baptism. We have to wonder why. The Anabaptists understood the Bible to say, "Whosoever believeth and is baptized shall be saved." That's what the Anabaptists believed. They said that's what the Bible teaches. The Reformers insisted that without baptism, your child is going to be lost should it die. So they turned that around. They said, well, you got to be baptized first. Then belief and faith can come later. That's not what the Bible said. The Bible says, he that believeth. Faith, the Anabaptists said, children are not capable of having a saving faith. They don't understand what's involved. They don't understand the doctrine of salvation and the doctrine of sin and all of that that they need to understand before they can have faith. So that was a major obstacle. The Anabaptists generally were not in too much danger until they were re-baptized. That's where the word Anabaptists come from. The word Anna in the Latin is again, to be baptized again. And that was the ultimate sin for people to allow themselves to be re-baptized. Those that had been baptized as babies and then become believers later in life, and then they want to have a believer's baptism, the authorities did not molest them too much until they went for that second baptism, and when the authorities discovered that they had allowed themselves to be rebaptized, that was their death penalty. That was often the death penalty. As long as they had not allowed themselves to be rebaptized, the authorities said, well, maybe he's an Anabaptist, maybe he's not. We don't know for sure. But once they were rebaptized, there was no doubt left. Then they knew for sure, this man or woman is an Anabaptist and is eligible for persecution. Another one was the Mass versus the Lord's Supper. The Anabaptists believed in a clean and pure communion table. The state churches did not have, certainly not the Catholic Church, what they practiced. Mass was unscriptural, and I won't spend any time on that. But even the state churches like the Lutheran and the Reformed, when you baptize children into the church, babies, when they get older, they're still carnal individuals. They've not been transformed. They have not been born again. How can you say that they are Christians? They needed to... The Anabaptists said they needed to experience conversion and then experience a believer's baptism. Point number four was a freedom of conscience. The Anabaptists believed in the freedom of each believer to be the priest of God, like Hebrews teaches us that we are a royal priesthood. Pardon me, that's Peter. A royal priesthood. Every believer has the capacity of priesthood within him, a direct relationship with God. There's other things involved with that, of course, but five, the Christian principle of not taking the sword. The reformers could never lay down the sword and separate church and state. And they still haven't been able to do that. The Swiss Reformed Church and the Swiss government are still married partners, although there's some more liberties there than what there used to be. But the Anabaptists said, the Bible, the gospel teaches Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and other passages of scripture, that we cannot resist evil with the sword. That's an unscriptural and an untenable position for a Christian to take. More recently, I've just read again the other day about Bible scholars and theologians that they teach the Sermon on the Mount as a part of the gospel that is not for our day, simply because it's not practical. We're living in a society that applying that gospel principles of non-resistance, for instance, doesn't work in our society. They say that is for sometime in the future, a more ideal utopia kind of society. Then we can all live by those principles. Well, they'll be waiting a long time, I think. They'll be waiting a long time. The Anabaptists said, no, those principles are for us today. Jesus taught them to his disciples, to his followers, and he never indicated that those principles were for sometime in the future. No, they were for then. They are for today, 2016. Those principles the Anabaptists took very seriously. The Bible doctrine of love toward all men, the Anabaptists were outstanding in that they manifested love toward all men. Most of you have seen that picture of the Dutch Anabaptist, I've forgotten his name now, that turned around, went back, rescued his pursuer out of the river. He had broke through the ice. What was that man's name? Dirk Willems. That picture very literally depicts what the Anabaptists believed. They did. They believed that. The Bible doctrine of love toward all men. The equality of all believers. The Anabaptists did not believe that the clergy was up here somewhere and the common church members were down here. They believed that the ministers were servants of God to the church, and then they were on the same spiritual level as all believers, equality of believers. They believed in separation of church and state. They believed in holiness of life. In the state church, there was a lot of carnality and corruption, even among the clergy. It's said that towards the end of his life, Luther bemoaned the fact that in Lutheran churches all across Germany, there were corrupt ministers, pastors, leading those churches. He admitted that that was not scriptural. He admitted that that wasn't his vision for the church at all. But it was his theology that produced that. The Anabaptists said, no, that is not a scriptural church. Sin must be removed from the brotherhood and from the ministry, from the leadership. It cannot be allowed to remain with any church and congregation and expect God's blessing. That is a brief overview of our Anabaptist heritage. I have about two more pages of details I thought I might be able to cover, but I see the time is up. So may God help us to appreciate what our Anabaptist forefathers, our brothers and sisters went through. Yes, there were even sisters that were drowned, that were burned at the stake, that endured manifold sufferings in order to stand for what they believed was truth.